You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. I am Dr. Kristen Lierley, and today I am here with my friend Nikki Sapiro-Venkier. She is an OBGYN PA who spent over a decade in clinical practice until this pride pin wearing patient advocate was fired because she wasn't a good fit for the company. So Nikki found another way to empower her patients, and she is doing incredible work. She's finding a way for them to receive the safe, thoughtful, evidence-based healthcare information that we all deserve. She founded Take Back Trust. It's takebacktrust.com, a website where you can go to get information about your personal healthcare, how to approach it, what are those answers that you're seeking, and how can you feel more empowered as you're seeking that kind of care? She's all over social media. Nikki also wrote a book, We Deserve More, which is available for order now. It's going to be released pretty soon. We'll let you know all the details about that. But the book pulls back the curtain on why reproductive healthcare is so fundamentally broken and what you can actually do about it. So we are going to have a lot to talk about. But here's where I really want to focus our conversation today. It's the gap, the chasm between how we as clinicians take care of our patients, what we can do, what lawmakers think they know when they're writing laws about women's healthcare, and the absolute flood of garbage information that's out there online right now that people are turning to because they don't have access to other stuff. And they're using this misinformation to make really important healthcare decisions that affect them for the rest of their lives. So this is going to be an amazing conversation. I'm so excited. Nikki, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. And I've had a few people introduce me before, but having you introduce me for some reason really got me kind of emotional. And I think it's because I haven't seen a lot of people that work well with APPs. So as a physician assistant, we're what's called advanced practice providers. And I'm so used to fighting to claim space when I'm with physicians. I'm used to fighting to say, hey, you've got to respect the work and the things that I do. And to have a physician introduce me with such kindness, respect, and mutual admiration like I have for you was really, really amazing. So just a shout out also to all the docs that understand that it's a team, to all the nurses and PAs and NPs and nurse midwives. We all work better when we work together. And so it got me really, we got this verklempt. It felt really good hearing you introduce me. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. You know, it comes from the heart because you are absolutely right. We have to be a team working together. So I am a big fan of working with physician assistants and nurse practitioners and, you know, all of the other folks that you just mentioned. And I'm also a big fan of working on behalf of my patients. And so are you. You and I wear this too. I wear a pride flag on my lapel. I've got one on my name tag. And you wouldn't believe the number of patients who see that and you can just see them go,
yes.
Yeah. Like this is a safe space.
Yeah.
Because there's so much stigma and so much history where patients come to us and all they expect is the kind of care that they historically have gotten that doesn't actually suit them. And you had a difficult relationship, like despite the fact that you were proven and had all of this historical experience working with patients, that pride pin, the way you talk to your patients made you not a good fit. Mm-hmm. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so it started when I was in PA school. When I got my white coat, I went to USC, and in California, it's obviously a little more progressive than it is here in the Midwest. So I live in Michigan now in a very purple area. And I had put a pride pin on my white coat the day that I got my white coat. My short white coat, my student white coat, right?
So embarrassing, yeah.
and I wore a pride pin every single day. And sometimes I would change them. They would be more eclectic than other times. And sometimes it was a flag. Most often it was just a rainbow heart. And it was exactly what you said. It was such this feeling of disarming for people, this, mm-hmm. this feeling of safety, this feeling of, oh, I can say what I want to say here. I can be myself in here. I can ask questions in here. And I think that's the part as a clinician that was so important to me, is I wanted to be a safe space, but I didn't necessarily need to even say, hey, I'm a safe space. Like, I wanted you to feel it. And it's mm-hmm. a feeling when you're in the room. And so I think that that show of solidarity is critical, because yes, of course, you can show up the same way, but having something that speaks before you even open your mouth changes the entire dynamic. Mm-hmm. And after almost 10 years at the practice, I was told that I had to take that pin off. And I told them that I didn't feel comfortable with that, that was a large part of who I was as a clinician and who I wanted to be as a clinician, that I didn't want to be the person that was going to be like, oh, okay, sure, no problem. I'll just take the pin off. It doesn't change anything. Because I knew fundamentally that that did change things. And it was such this cornerstone of my identity as a clinician. And in that same conversation, I had also been told that I wasn't allowed to talk about voting with my patients, despite the fact that I talked about voting in a nonpartisan way, which is recommended by both the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology as being a part of your civic health, right? We know that this is critical. And when I was told that I couldn't talk about voting, I said, I don't agree with that, nor do the major medical associations. And 2 days later, I was fired and told I was not a professional fit. So it was really interesting to see practices cower to fear, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we're seeing that across the board right now. It was that it's too polarizing for them. And that's a ridiculous comment, right? Like, as clinicians, I think we need to always be the ones who advocate for the underdogs. And so it was hugely disappointing.
We see this all the time, though. I mean, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, my college, your college, we recently issued a statement saying that we support standing up, clinicians who stand up for our patients. And we advise organizations to allow that, because that is not reality. And what you did, I think, was really unique and unusual. Most clinicians will back down. They'll just take the pin off. That's the easy thing to do. That's the least resistance, but it doesn't serve our patients. So it takes a hell of a lot of courage to do that. I want to talk about, you left clinical practice, you started creating, you made the website, and then you started creating content online and wrote your book, We Deserve More. By the way, I'm talking with Nikki Sapiro Vinkier. She's an OBGYN PA who just wrote this amazing book. And the timing of all of this other work that you're doing matters, because we're living in a moment where abortion bans and other reproductive health legislation have made it painfully, embarrassingly obvious how disconnected lawmakers are from real healthcare. And that impacts every single one of us. What have you seen?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's so much to comment on the disconnect from lawmakers to clinical care. And I think the biggest one I've seen, obviously, is just women not getting care the way that they need, right? It's the Caitlin Joshuas of the world, woman who was miscarrying at 11 weeks down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and went to 3 different ERs and was continuously refused miscarriage treatment because it can be confused with abortion care, which is absurd, right? And it took her 2 months. 2 full months to pass her miscarriage on her own, right? So it's
while she's bleeding every day, she's in pain, it's time away from work, it's affecting your medical and psychological approach to life. It's so many things that people don't realize the impact of this.
Yeah, and she's a mother already. And I think that that's the conversation too, is that there's such stigmas that are held around abortion care. And number one, I firmly believe, obviously, that everyone should have access to abortion care, no matter when, if, whatever, right? But for those who don't believe in that, I think they're not aware of the repercussions of these abortion bans because they don't understand how intimately tied abortion bans are to miscarriage management. And abortion bans are to requiring travel to go out of state for necessary treatments, how costly it is, how this disproportionately impacts Black and Brown women, how it's just like one thing after the other. It's this kind of topple down effect. And they don't know because they're not in the rooms.
And they don't care. I know. And that's appropriate because it's so frustrating because we see as healthcare providers the pain that our patients go through. I mean, I think the most impactful example for a general audience is people with a complicated pregnancy who find out at 20 weeks that their baby doesn't have a brain or whatever the condition is, that their baby will not survive the pregnancy. And now they're in a situation where they have to travel out of state. If they can even do that, if they have the money, if they have the support, if they have the resources, if they have the counseling, it makes it impossible. And that's just the mechanics of it. That has nothing to do with how this family, how this woman, how the people around her suffer in a situation like that. But you see that firsthand.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, right? I think that it's so easy for people on the other side to say, oh, well, adoption is a counter to abortion, right? And if you don't want the baby, then put it up for adoption, which number one, that's not a good option or a good substitute. But number two, in these cases where patients have these pregnancies where there's significant fetal anomalies, adoption's not going to be an option, right? Mm-hmm. So then you're forcing this, like, number one, pain and suffering on the child, pain and suffering on the family, cost, medical bills, all of these different things. And that's a significant burden that lawmakers don't know anything about, nor should they be in the place to make that decision.
No, and they don't care. Like we said, I just want to really emphasize, like, they really don't care because they're thinking about politics and we're thinking about our patients. Yeah. So when you hear politicians say things like, this is one of my favorites, ectopic pregnancies can be reimplanted in the uterus, or there are no medically necessary abortions. What goes through your head when you hear them talking about these things that you know just are not real?
Yeah, there was another one recently too, where they were talking about, I don't know if you saw this, a colonoscopy, how you could do it if you swallow a pill with a camera. Yes. And they asked if the same thing could be done with monitoring a pregnancy. Which of course cannot, because your uterus does not conduct. And it was just this ridiculous concept of, you really don't even understand basic anatomy.
And yes, and they, again, don't want to know. So they intentionally don't talk to people like us who are outspoken, who have actually stuck our necks out to stand up for our patients, which is all part of the reason why we do the work that we do. If you could sit across from a state legislator who is drafting a piece of reproductive healthcare legislation right now, what's the one thing you need them to understand? You got 30 seconds.
Oh, I would tell them that there's no routine care. There's no, like, standard that applies to every person and every woman. And there's no way you can possibly legislate a single thing that would apply to every single person, that there is so much nuance in care and nuance in situation that there is no way to possibly legislate for the nuance.
Yeah, you can't write this stuff into law. And it changes.
It changes.
Yeah, something that might be true now is not going to be true down the road. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I am talking with Nikki Sapiro-Vinkier. She is an OBGYN PA. She just wrote this amazing new book. When we come back, let's talk about what fills the gap when lawmakers fail and doctors and PAs and other healthcare providers stay silent. Here's a spoiler. It is TikTok, Reels, Shorts, and it's a mess. Stay with us.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
And we're back. Before the break, we were talking about how disconnected lawmakers are from clinical reality. But here's the other side of that problem. When you can't get straight answers from your healthcare provider and you know that you can't trust politicians, especially when it comes to healthcare, where do people go? They go online. and Nikki Sapiro-Vinkier, OBGYN PA. Your new book talks about this. Social media is both the problem and the solution. Break that down.
Yeah, I think for so many people, they leave their healthcare visit, and sometimes it's because their clinicians didn't give them a straight answer, like you said, and sometimes it's because they don't have enough time to go into it. Sometimes it's because they couldn't get in to see a clinician. So there's so many reasons why we're not getting what we need from clinical care. But what we have in our phone and our hands at all times is connection to others. It's connections to others who have had similar experiences. It's the ability to not feel alone in what we're having and what we're seeing and what we're feeling. And so there are examples of horrific mis and disinformation. We see so much bad stuff when it comes to talking about birth control online.
Oh, yeah.
And at the same time, there are incredible support groups on Facebook for endometriosis or miscarriage management and, you know, perinatal mental health management and support. And so there's this kind of disconnect where you can't out the gate say, everything online that you're going to be a part of is crap and everything is, you know, damaging and misinformation and don't trust that and it's the enemy. And I think that that's a problem for a lot of clinicians, that they're gatekeeping this feeling of like, I am the only master of information and I will be the only person who takes care of you. But they can't. They don't have time. They don't have resources. And they may not have that exact experience. And so for some to be able to feel seen and validated and a part of a community where other people do understand, it provides a lifeline. And so I'm really hesitant to say too many terrible things about online because I think it can be so helpful for so many people, with the caveat that you can really quickly and easily go down the rabbit hole into this kind of algorithmic trend and thread that feeds you some mis and disinformation. And so I always talk about kind of digital hygiene and making sure what you're looking into and researching is real and credible and evidence-based, and understanding the differences of, am I here because I want support, validation, mutual shared experiences, or am I looking for healthcare answers out of this? And I think there's a time and a place for both. But my concern is, of course, with the rampant mis and disinformation that we see.
Mm-hmm. And coming from sources that used to be really credible. I mean, one of the trickiest things is knowing, like, is this a credible source or not? And now even the things that we all used to rely on, like the CDC, not safe anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you turned your clinical practice into something much bigger and broader. You're a content creator. What made you decide to lean into this fray instead of away from it?
Because I was seeing over and over again, it kind of goes back to that same conversation we had earlier, probably because I created a safe space within my clinical exam rooms where my patients could come in and be like, hey, I saw this, or hey, this is what I'm feeling, right? Hey, this is what my best friend told me, or this is what my, you know, feed is continually telling me. And I felt like I was often combating the same things, right? And when we go back to that mis and disinformation, specifically around birth control, I would have young women in droves coming in wanting to get off of birth control because it was going to ruin their hormones forever, that it made them, you know, depressed and anxious, and it made them hate their boyfriends and this, that,
gain
whatever.
Gain weight. Yes.
And, right. All the things. And sure, there are some people who have side effects. So I'm not here to gaslight you and tell you that you don't have side effects that you think. But then going the complete opposite direction to, well, we're just going to try the pull-out method and pull and pray. I'm like, yeah, but do you know there's an abortion ban in this state? Or do you know, like, hey, that's a really, really problematic seismic shift. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I was kind of combating some of the mis and disinformation online in my exam rooms on a daily basis. And I was really, when I would go onto social media to be like, oh, I wonder what my patients are seeing. I wonder what their algorithms look like. I felt like there was just a drove of, you know, the wellness influencers and the wellness grifters, if we will, kind of talking about supplements and different things you can do for your hormone health and X, Y, and Z. And I was like, wow, we really need some more clinical voices here, and clinical voices that can reach people, yes. Right? I think a lot of the time clinical voices are really boring and they're just not getting across. And so I just started talking online and here we are.
So what can you say on social media that you couldn't say in the exam room, which seems so like backwards because you should be able to say things privately in an exam room with just one person, but instead you're broadcasting it to the world.
I think that I'm pretty much the same person that I was in clinic on social media. I don't think that I really held anything back as a clinician, which is probably why I got fired. Of course, I can be more partisan on social media. That's probably the one thing. In clinic, I was nonpartisan, but you could probably tell which way I sat based on the fact that I had purple hair and a pride pin. But
the lines are pretty clearly drawn.
Yeah, they should be. It should be that anyone who works in reproductive healthcare should sit on the side of reproductive healthcare, right? But it was mind-blowing to me that the physicians who employed me, it was about a 50-50 split of parties.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see how your fellow practitioners feel politically when they're willing to reveal that. So let's take a little break here. But when we come back, I want to dig into something you write about in the book that I think is so, so important. How the system isn't just broken, it was built broken. We're talking about J. Marion Sims, the Tuskegee study, and the things that we learn in our training. You are listening to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. I am talking with Nikki Sapiro-Vinkier. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. I'm Dr. Kristen Lierley, and I'm here with my friend Nikki Sapiro-Vinkier. She is an OBGYN PA by training, and she's also a creator. So you might see her on Instagram, TikTok, all over the place, talking about what you need to know as a consumer of reproductive healthcare, how you can go to your visits with the information and the support that you need to make sure that you get the care you deserve. Speaking of deserve, we're talking about her new book, We Deserve More. And Nikki, I want to go deep on something that you lay out in chapter one that most people, I didn't know this, most people have never been taught in their training. I'm really, really proud of my college, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, because a few years ago, before COVID, we started to look at the history of gynecology. We studied Lucy, Betsy, and Anarka, three enslaved Black women, and we started to honor them for their contributions because modern gynecology was really built on the backs of these women and others. Tell people about J. Marion Sims.
Yeah, so J. Marion Sims is often referred to as the grandfather of gynecology, and J. Marion Sims practiced his surgical techniques on enslaved Black women without anesthesia. So it's thought to be up to 30 enslaved Black women, but Betsy, Lucy, and Anarka had each undergone around 20 different surgeries. And then he would perfect, if you will, the surgery technique and go on to do it on white women with pain management and anesthesia. So when we talk about the misconception of pain in women, specifically Black women, this is a very deep-rooted, problematic history within gynecology, that women's pain, specifically Black women's pain, has long been ignored, not listened to, not respected. And so I didn't know that either. This wasn't anything I ever learned in PA school. And I was years into practicing gynecology when I learned this. And it was horrifying because when you talk about kind of systemic biases, this is what is built into gynecology. And then when you think about what Black women endure in gynecology, to think about that's the origin of this And now they're still getting such poor care and get such bad outcomes, right? We see Black maternal mortality. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts, despite the fact of anything being accounted for, right? Like, we look at Serena Williams, who almost died in childbirth, a woman who had all of the resources possible. Just this last week, there was a certified nurse midwife who had fought for Black maternal health care, and she herself died during childbirth of her first.
Let's just say her name to acknowledge Dr. Janelle Green Smith in South Carolina. Of course.
Yeah. So it's just, I think it's it needs to be not just named, but it needs to be acknowledged and discussed and actively broken down, because in gynecology right now, that's still not named, still not discussed. And so it's just this horrifying backstory and background that plants this basis for where gynecology grew. And when we look at why we're not getting what we need, it's not something that's new within the last, decades. This is something that fundamentally, from the very beginning, did not serve women. And so I think the biggest concern is birth for, centuries was done in communities with community birth workers. And then, we just completely colonized gynecology and obstetrics, and forced all of these community health workers out of these roles that they had been in, where they were so trusted and entrenched with their patients and friends and sisters and daughters, right? There was so much generational knowledge and experience, and we traded that for, the groundwork that is fundamentally flawed.
And now what we tend to see as providers, when we see especially Black women who come to us, if we're not aware of this past, it can be perceived as non-compliance or failure to follow through with the information that you're sharing. And I remember feeling that way early on in my practice before I really understood this. It's made me such a better doctor to understand it. This is exactly why I think about the Tuskegee study, which you write about. When you hear people say, well, I don't understand why people in Black communities don't trust vaccines or birth control. Like, you watch these people die for 40 years, even after they could be treated. And then you act surprised that trust is broken. We broke that trust, and now we're generations deep, and it's really hard to fix it.
Yeah. And I think there's not enough that's being done to intentionally look at that and intentionally say, okay, this was really wrong. And how do we fix the fact that not only was this wrong, but then we've continued to use this same thread to continue to move medicine forward? And that's the part, I think, that makes me feel emotional to get that introduction from you, is I don't feel like there are very many physicians who are willing to take a very thoughtful look at the flaws of their training, at the flaws of the basis of what they know, the foundation of what they know, and be willing to say, oh, this is built on something bad. How do I do this better?
I am really excited to tell you something you probably don't even know. I do a lot of work with ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and there has been a giant acknowledgement of how we recognize this and lift it up, not just with our patients, but with our providers. So I think we're on the path, but we have so much more to do. And it doesn't solve the problem of providers who hear this history and say, yeah, but it wasn't me. I mean, I'm not responsible for that. What would you say to those people? You've worked with those people. I've worked with those people.
Yeah, they're the people that still tell you you're just going to feel a little pinch, right? It's the fact that they tell you that your IUD insertion is going to feel like just a little cramp. Mm. It's the gaslighting and the refusal of acknowledgement that there is a multitude of experiences for different people, right? That we do feel pain, that we are entitled to pain management, mm-hmm. right? My partner got a vasectomy, and you know what? His full anesthesia, he was under anesthesia for it,
what?
Was really? Covered by insurance, and it cost us $42 because he got full anesthesia for his vasectomy because he gets queasy.
Oh boy. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, you don't want to take that away.
Like, I don't want to take it away from him. And I'm happy he had the care that was beneficial for him. And that should be offered across the board to women as well.
Yes, 100%. So we've got this foundation that's built on exploitation and experimentation. But let's fast forward to what's happening today. OBGYN training, for all of its good things and flaws, it's still pretty broken, just in different ways. And you write about how the specialty is trained for emergencies, but not for everyday health. I have certainly seen that in my own experience. From your lens, what does that look like?
Oh, yeah. Where do you start on that one? You know, it's just an impossible scope of practice that you guys are expected to cover. And so I think that that's the challenge of it, is that we expect you to be primary care providers and surgeons all at the same time. And it's a lot. So I will be the first to say I didn't go through this training. I am not a physician. I respect the OBGYNs that I've worked with and alongside and know tremendously. So I don't mean to rain on the parade of the incredible work and knowledge that you do have. But when you focus so intently on emergency outcomes and emergency management, there isn't enough time for that primary care, you know, daily management. And we see this in practice. And I think that's a beautiful thing about PAs and nurse practitioners in gynecological care. That is the bread and butter for APPs in gynecological care, is an annual exam. Mm-hmm. I can talk to you all day long and provide you excellent care, and I don't need to operate on you. And that's a great thing. So I do think that there's this beauty in being able to have a good pairing within a clinical practice, because that is what we are, is we are physician extenders in providing that quality of care as it relates to non-emergent issues is brilliant. And a lot of the time, physicians don't have that, or they try to do it all and they simply can't. And we see that they're not trained well enough on menopause. They're not trained well enough on like a lot of these like day-to-day things. And as women in 2026 now, we're talking about it more. We're demanding mm-hmm. more. We need better acknowledgement of what we're feeling, of these period and menstrual issues that we've been having, of our PCOS, of our endometriosis, of our menopausal symptoms, of our contraceptive needs. Like, it's ongoing, and it's not taught in residency thoroughly enough.
Hey, this is the teamwork that you're talking about, how you mentioned that PAs and nurse practitioners tend to do a lot of the preventive care. And I will just, I'll share that I had an amazing PA who I worked with, and I'm going to say her name, Kim Shefchik. She is the reason that I'm so PA friendly, because she's brilliant and amazing. And the way that we work together provided such beautiful care for our patients. They yeah. knew that we were their team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be very honest, when I went through medical school, there was very little information about things like menopause. We learned a lot about hemorrhages, which is great. We need that. But I honestly didn't know how to manage somebody going through the menopausal transition, because the climate wasn't right. It was there was a lot happening in women's health. It was political. It was so many other things. And that makes it really hard for us to provide that good comprehensive care for our patients. And that doesn't even begin to touch people who are coming in with painful sex, or from the LGBTQ+ community, or people who most have experienced some sort of trauma, but nobody ever taught us about trauma-informed care. Can you speak a little bit to caring for these patients who have these special needs, which is nearly all of us, if you're being honest with yourself?
Yeah. And not only is it nearly all of us, but only 8% of women actually disclose to their clinician that they have experienced sexual trauma. And so that's the piece that I think is really missing, is clinicians tend to have this very skewed perception of, oh, well, it's not my patients, but it is your patients. They just aren't telling you. And maybe that they don't feel safe enough to tell you, or maybe they don't want to freaking talk about it. And either way is fine, right? But it's so deep that there are so many women who have visceral reactions, that have flashbacks during, you know, their pelvic exams, that aren't told what to expect. And as clinicians, we have these like scripts that we go through over and over again. You know, we've done thousands, hundreds of thousands of pap smears, and we say more or less a similar thing every time. Mm-hmm. And it tends to not be from a trauma-informed consent based lens. Yes. And it isn't a, hey, here's what I'm going to do. Is this okay with you? And here's what you can expect. Is that okay? You know, it's this like, okay, you're going to feel this. And then next you're going to feel this scratchy sensation. And it's expecting that women are going to just sit on the exam table and just bear it, right? Just like exist in that moment. And how much that does to trauma, it just reinforces any pre-existing trauma.
Yes. And we have so much more to talk about in only one more segment, Nikki. So when we come back, I've got Nikki Sapiro-Vink here. We are going to talk about what people can do. We've talked a lot about what we can't do, but what can you do? You are listening to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to the Dr. Kristen Lierley Show. It's me, Dr. Kristen Lierley, and I'm here with my friend Nikki Sapiro-Vink here. She's an OBGYN PA. She just wrote this amazing book called We Deserve More. She's going to tell you how to find it at the end of the segment. But first, I want you to listen, because this conversation's been fantastic, first of all. We've talked about why the system is broken, how misinformation fills the gap, what we're up against. But Nikki, your book, We Deserve More, is about practical tools. You give people hope and information and the tools that they need to be empowered in the exam room, which is a pretty disempowering place. What's one thing that people who are listening right now can do before their next appointment to advocate for themselves?
Great question. One thing I would do is really make sure that you've paid attention to yourself. What are the things that you're struggling with? What are the things that you need? And make sure when you're going in that you have the right appointment booked. Mm-hmm. So I think that success starts at scheduling. And more often than not, people go for their annual exam with a laundry list of questions and issues. And an annual exam is not meant to address problem issues. It's meant for preventative care. And I wish more people understood this, because they don't. And then they leave their annual exam feeling so disappointed that they didn't get all their questions and all of their needs met, when that exam is for a different purpose. And so I think that the best thing that you can do if you're going into an appointment is figure out, what are you really looking for from that visit? Is there an issue that's been bothering you? Not seven issues, but one or two issues, and focus that visit on one or two issues so you can really do a deep dive on it, right? And you may need multiple appointments if you have seven issues. I'm not telling you don't address all seven of them, but I do think it's important to really prioritize what your needs are and in what order do you want to address them, and then make the appointments appropriately to be able to do so.
And one step at a time. Find a clinician who sees you as a whole person, not just a problem, but someone who you can build a relationship with. Talk a little bit about that, making sure that you are seeing the right person for you.
Yeah, you know, we've been kind of building on that all along, right? Uh-huh. Is that within gynecology and within medicine, there are so many different specialties and so many different types of clinicians. You have, you know, if it's painful sex, it might be a pelvic floor physical therapist that you actually need to be seeing, right? If it's that you want this kind of conversational care, you may not need to see a surgeon. If it's that you have endometriosis that does require surgical management, you need a surgical specialist to do that. And so really understanding kind of the landscape of the different levels of training, the different layers of training, and who does what is really impactful. Because a lot of times people will go to their gynecologist for more of the primary care management needs. And so I think it's really having a combination of the right team lined up. It's having primary care, it's having OBGYN, it's pelvic floor PT if you need it. It's a psychologist or psychiatrist if you need it also. And there's no shame or stigmas in having multiple people able to take care of you. And you want teams that can work together. So asking them for people that they've worked with in the past, because a warm referral and a warm handoff within patients can be a really wonderful thing in getting better care.
It makes you feel cared for, not just handed off.
Yeah.
Your book isn't just a book. It has a workbook that goes along with it.
It does.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So this was kind of an accident. It was supposed to be part of the actual book. And then there were just so many different scenarios that I wanted to talk about. And so there's 27 different scenarios within gynecological healthcare, whether it's managing an ovarian cyst, whether it's perimenopause and menopausal treatment, whether it's single motherhood by choice, whether it's, you know, all sorts of different topics that you can talk about with your clinician, and different ways to track symptoms that you may have thought about, different ways to lean into your own needs, and then different scripts and ways and words that you can ask your clinician for that care. So I joke that it's kind of on accident, because the idea was just to have this additional support. And then I just kept building, and I'd have friends that would text me and be like, hey, this is going on. What do I need to know about it? And I was like, well, shoot, I don't have a scenario for that. And I'm like deep in editing right now. And my cousin texted me last week and she's like, Nikki, I have an ovarian cyst. And I was like, damn it.
There's another one.
Here's another one. So I sent it to my editor. I was like, you're going to kill me. But I totally forgot about this. And it's really just so you're not going down the rabbit hole of Google alone. And I, with the workbook, I wrote intentionally in the preface of it, I want you to treat this like a sisterhood of a traveling pants. I want you to take this workbook and toss it over to your best friend if they are in the middle of an experience that they need more support in, right? And I don't think that this knowledge should be gatekept. I think it needs to just get out into the world. And so that's what the workbook was for.
I feel like this workbook is a first edition, and there will be more, because there are, as a practicing clinician, there are endless circumstances that we run into. Nikki, how can people find your book and the workbook?
Oh, thank you. So you can follow me on any social media thing, whether it be TikTok, Instagram, at Nikki Vink, N-I-K-K-I-V-I-N-C-K. I have links in my bio. It's called We Deserve More. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the major booksellers. You'll be able to find the book, We Deserve More.
And we will have the link in our podcast notes. Nikki Sapiro Vinkier, thank you so much for writing this book, for the work that you do, and for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Friends, if you missed any part of our conversation, you can always find it on civicmedia.us, Spotify, Apple, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can watch it on YouTube at Dr. Kristen Lyerly. And don't forget to like, subscribe, ring the bell, all those things. You can also find me and Nikki on nearly all the socials. For a blast. You should really follow us. Many thanks to our wonderful team, Conrad Kruger, our producer today, our technical advisor, Nick Tierman, who also composed the theme song, graphic design by Nathaniel Gonzalez, and of course, Abraham Lyerly, who does everything. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Dr. Kristen Lyerly, reminding you to take care of yourself and each other. We'll see you next week.
The national news cycle never stops. but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.